Hello and welcome to episode 25 of Engaging Internal Comms. This is the show for employee engagers and internal communicators who like to keep up to date with all that is new in our profession. My name's Craig Smith from The Big Picture People. So here we are, episode 25. If this is the first time you've listened to the show, welcome. You're more than welcome, and it's great to have you on board. There's 24 episodes that you can listen to on our website, engagingic.com, or you can listen to via your podcast platform. Whatever you're listening to this podcast on now, you will be able to find our previous episodes. Next week, I have an interview with Costanza Tabino, who works for an organization called Stats Perform, which is a company that looks at looking at sports data for all sorts of different uses. But Costanza is not going to be telling us about that. She's going to be talking to us all about using humor in internal communications. Now, some of you might be thinking, oh, goodness, particularly the current times that we're in at the moment, is it feasible? Is it appropriate to use humor in internal communications? Costanza is going to be telling about us all about her experiences, how she has used humor very successfully to transmit and to get engagement around some really diverse topic areas. So really, really fun interview, as you would expect, but also with some really, really serious messages. So I think you'll find that one quite a good one to engage with. So if you've not already done so, please do join our mailing list. You can do that via engagingic.com. You can sign up to the list there. You will get a notification of what's coming up in episodes to come, and you'll get an email on the day just to remind you when a podcast has been broadcast. Also, you via our website, engagingic.com, you can join our Facebook group. There's a link on there to take you to our Facebook group, which is our community. You're more than welcome to join that. Just click on the link there. If you want to go directly to Facebook, if you type engagingic into that, you should be able to find us as well. If you haven't already done so, please subscribe to the show. It makes a big difference for us in terms of our visibility, but also means, again, that you don't have to remember to download your episode of Engaging Internal Comms each week. It will be in your podcast player, ready for you to listen to every Tuesday morning when you're doing whatever you're doing. So that would be wonderful if you could do that. So on to the rest of today's show. As professionals within internal communications or employee engagement, or indeed any other branch of human resources within our organization, we need to be able to understand how to influence our leaders, but we also need to be able to understand the impact that our leaders' behaviors have on our agenda, whether we're trying to drive an engagement agenda or whether we're trying to change the culture of our organization through great internal communications. A really important part of that is the ability of our leaders to engage and empathize with their followers within the organization, with our employees within the organization. And one of the areas I wanted to explore was a concept known as motivational intelligence. That is the ability of people to be able to manage themselves and to manage others within the organization in terms of managing their motivational profile and how well they are able to engage with people and to inspire them and to breed support. So that was what I wanted to look at. And I reached out to an expert in this area who's going to give us a really interesting five-element model or a model of motivational intelligence that is broken into five key areas that he's going to explain during this interview. And as you're listening to it, what I want you to do is reflect on, within your own organization, do your leaders demonstrate some of these qualities? And is this something that you could potentially look at as an area of development for them, and as your role as a trusted advisor to help them to be more self-aware of these factors within the organization? And at the same time, maybe to look at your own motivational intelligence and ask yourself, are there areas that I could perhaps improve or develop? So that's what today's interview is all about. So my guest today is David Naylor. David is EVP at TooLogical, which is a leading global consultancy supporting organizations such as General Motors, Bank of America, American Express, L'Oreal, and Tate & Lyle, to name but a few. David is an author, a Forbes contributor. He's a LinkedIn advisor, and his team run the Motivational Intelligence podcast. And I'm going to put a link to the Motivational Intelligence podcast in the show notes for this episode. So hi, David. Just if you could tell us where you are, please.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Craig, and I'm happy to be a part of the show. And I am based in New York, and then Toologico is actually headquartered here in New York, but then we have offices in the UK, we have offices in the Middle East, and also in Australia. So we do business all over the world.
Fantastic. And tell us a little bit more about Toologico. What is your core offering? I mentioned a few of the clients that you're working with. Tell us a little bit more about the business, please.
Yeah, absolutely. So the company itself is a little bit more than three decades old. We do work in, I think, a little more than 90 countries at this stage, six different continents. Most of what we do is in the leadership and consulting space. So we help organizations as they're navigating through various types of challenges, transitions. You know, obviously right now, everything is happening with the pandemic. Mm. And then we also build out leadership universities for organizations. So whether they're looking for something comprehensive, so they're how do you transition people from being an individual contributor to being a supervisor to management and, you know, through the course of their careers, right on up to working with executives at the C-suite.
Fantastic. Excellent. Oh, that's thank you. Thank you. That's very comprehensive. So I guess there's lots we could talk about there. I mean, the one area that I said I'm really interested in talking to you about was this concept of motivational intelligence. And one of the wonders of this podcast is I'm unearthing loads of things that I probably should have known about. But when I find them, they're amazing. And I'm just kind of kicking myself that I'd not really, found this concept before. So, and I think there may be a few people in the similar boat. You know, we kind of know about emotional intelligence and such like. Could you just give me a kind of flavor for what we mean by motivational intelligence in this context, in the context of the work that you do, David?
Yeah, absolutely, Craig. So, you know, if you look at our understanding of ourselves as human beings, you know, that we discovered the concept of an IQ back in the early 1900s. I think it was a French psychologist who, initially came up with the concept and a way to quantify it. In the 1960s, we discovered that wasn't the only type of intelligence we have as human beings. We, through some research that was done at Yale, it was discovered that we have something called emotional intelligence, which is really our understanding and our awareness of our emotions and how our emotions are influencing our behaviors. Well, what's happened more recently is we've discovered there's a third type of human intelligence. The research on it actually dates back to the 1950s and some work that was done at Harvard by a gentleman, Dr. David McClellan. But more recently, there's been a lot of work that was done out of Stanford University. One of the researchers, a lady by the name of Dr. Carol Dweck. And as she was researching the human mind, she discovered that there are really two different types of mindsets that we as human beings can operate under. One she referred to as a fixed mindset, and the other is a growth mindset. People with fixed mindsets, they have a tendency to, look at other people and believe that others can do things that they can't. They look at themselves from more of a fixed perspective. And so they have a more limiting belief system about themselves, their capabilities, and thus even their perspective on the world. The people with a growth mindset, conversely, are individuals who believe that they have broader capabilities, that they've got the ability with practice and additional effort to learn new things, to embrace new things, and thus they give themselves permission in a different way. So what motivational intelligence is it's really the driver, if you will, of whether an individual is operating under a fixed mindset or a growth mindset. So just to define it, to kind of help clarify, what motivational intelligence is, it's an individual's awareness of their awareness and their ability to manage negative thoughts and self-limiting. And the degree to which we can do that, to no small extent, is the degree to which that we move through life encumbered or unencumbered. And obviously, this has huge ripple effects in the business world. In fact, virtually every people problem that we see in the, you know, in organizations today stems back from an issue that is rooted right here.
Mm. Okay. I mean, that's sparking loads of connections for me. So, you know, I'm thinking kind of locus of control. I think that's mm-hmm. that's a similar concept, isn't it? And I guess, you know, looking at maybe kind of more mainstream or kind of popular, you know, more in the mainstream, I guess, like Covey's circles of concern influence, that, you know, it's that ability to accept accountability, to recognize and the Viktor Frankl stuff around, you know, what you can control and what you can't control. Yeah. Yeah. And your reactions and your responses are really the things that you should be aware of. And yeah. Okay. So it's really making a lot of connections for me now. How would an organization or an individual within an organization recognize that motivational intelligence is something that they need to focus on, other than maybe through intuition? Because I guess what we're looking at here is a way of, in some way, quantifying this and calibrating mm-hmm. this, and being able to measure this. Is that the sort of thing that we're looking at, and what you would recommend?
Well, what you'll see is there are five characteristics that you will see in an individual who is either rooted the right way or the wrong way with regard to their motivational intelligence. So the five characteristics, and you keyed in right on one of them, Craig, and that's accountability. So individuals who struggle with motivational intelligence, they tend to operate under a victim mindset. They spend a lot of time pointing fingers and placing blame, making excuses, rationalizing why they can't be successful. Conversely, individuals who have higher levels of motivational intelligence, what you'll see in them is a significantly higher level of ownership. So they'll take ownership for accomplishing the goals that you know have been set. They will take ownership for learning the things that they need to learn in order to accomplish those goals. And they'll also take ownership for finding the solutions to the problems they encounter in pursuit of those goals. So they become solution oriented rather than problem focused. So accountability is decidedly one of the things that you'll see in people with higher levels of motivational intelligence. Adaptability is another one of the core outgrowths. What happens when people struggle with motivational intelligence? They tend to be closed-minded. They are very difficult to coach because they don't listen well. They are individuals who oftentimes will fight feedback. So if a manager is sitting there trying to have a coaching conversation, they will, you know, they'll be telling the manager why the feedback that they're providing isn't accurate or isn't relevant, they tend to be very risk averse, which, you know, again, keeps them rooted and less adaptable. Conversely, people who are stronger here, open-minded, they actually actively seek out feedback. They are more reflective, a lot easier for us to lead in that sense. So that's the second characteristic. Third one is resilience. The fourth characteristic is a willingness to take initiative. And the fifth characteristic is the ability to move with courage, so to not be ruled by fears and self-doubts. So you'll see either problems in those five areas if an individual is struggling, or even a team is struggling with motivational intelligence, or they'll move in a more positive sense in those five areas if they have stronger motivational intelligence.
And that's a good summary, and I can relate to all of those. I think all of those five areas that you just mentioned there, but I mean, as I said, accountability I definitely relate to, but certainly that idea of resilience and willingness for feedback. I guess what I'm thinking here, one of the things that's coming to my mind is probably the people who need this most, who maybe have the biggest gap when it comes to their motivational intelligence, maybe the ones ironically then who are the most resistant to getting the feedback. So how do you kind of overcome that? Because that's a bit of a paradox, isn't it? The ones who are kind of lead at the least are probably going to be the most receptive to the feedback. How would you go about approaching or dealing with that potential challenge?
Yeah, wonderful question, Craig, and very insightful in that regard as well. And it's one of the things over the course of the last 30 years, we worked on designing training systems to impact people at this level. Mm. One of the things you can't, if If an individual is struggling with their motivational intelligence, really what they're struggling with is they're struggling with a flawed belief set. And you can't fix somebody's belief set by telling them that it's broken or it's wrong. You know, our beliefs are the most core fundamental thing that we hold from a psychological perspective. So the way that you change somebody's beliefs is you actually use something that was discovered back in the 1950s by a gentleman, Dr. Leon Fessinger. Fessinger is actually incredible, probably the most well-regarded of modern-day psychologists. What he discovered is a principle called cognitive dissonance. Mm-hmm. And it is a proven principle that's used extensively today in advertising, psychotherapy, and in politics, and to influence people's belief sets. And that's really the way that you go about helping an individual increase the level of their motivational intelligence. So that you've got to challenge their belief sets in a way that they let go of their limiting beliefs and they open themselves up to a more optimal belief.
Yeah, and I know a little bit about cognitive dissonance, and like that's all around that you can't hold two equally opposing mindsets at the same time. You have to kind of give up one. And I guess what you're saying there is you give them one that's more compelling than the one they're holding on to, and encourage them to let go of that and embrace the new one that you're offering to them. Yeah. Is that the sort of the principle that you tend to operate with?
And that's you defined it very well, Craig. You're exactly right. What Fessinger discovered is that as human beings, we cannot hold two opposing dominant beliefs, because the human mind needs to, we act upon our dominant beliefs. So if we have two opposing ones, we don't know how to act. That's that dissonance process. So what we do through the training side of things, and we don't explain this, of course, to participants, but what we do is we have went through the course of the discussions as we're working with organizations and individuals, we introduce an opposing belief to their limited belief. And then what we do is very sequentially through the course of the conversation, there's a lot of psychology that goes into it. What we do is we undermine the validity of the limiting belief, and we build up the validity of the optimal belief. So if you look at it this way, think of it as if you think about that childhood game that likely many of us played, where we were, we had two teams on opposite ends of a rope, and we were playing tug of war, pulling the rope back and forth. It's very much the same way in the human mind. And so on one side, you've got a limiting belief, on the other side, you have an optimal belief. And then you just decide which of those beliefs is going to carry by making one stronger and one weaker. And that's how you shift people's mindsets, or that's how you move them from having a fixed mindset to having a growth mindset. And it's truly incredible to watch what happens in not just in an individual's career, but really in their life as they go through this. Because once you've moved them from one side to the other, it doesn't just affect a singular area of their life. So we have 30 years of stories of people talking about how they changed the way they interacted with their children, or that it saved their marriage, or, so it ripples in every single aspect of their life. And then of course there's, some pretty significant corporate, things that happen as well.
Yeah. A rising tide raises all ships. It's a sort
exactly.
of similar. Yeah. Definitely. Definitely. I mean, I'm really interested in that, can you scale up that cognitive dissonance in an organization? Because sometimes it's not just individuals, it's whole groups of people, isn't it? I've worked in environments where, there's a collective cognitive dissonance between what we really think, we would like them to believe, and what they, are collectively have this sort of hold on. And then again, it links back to what we were talking about earlier, the kind of victim mindset, this sort of sometimes this identity that people find in being, with a bunch of other victims and kind of colluding with them. And I was just wondering, is this anything that you've ever seen work or you think could work, where an organization, maybe through either its communications or through some sort of organizational development, looks to challenge where there's a groupthink around that, where it's not just a one or two individuals? Or would you start with individuals and try and influence them and scale that out? How would you approach that sort of situation?
Well, it's, you know, and you talk a lot about culture, and this is really the essence of the culture work that we do in organizations, because what a culture is, and, you know, from a corporate standpoint, it's the collective set of dominant beliefs of a group of people. And so from an organizational perspective, the broadest lever we have of organizational performance is the culture that we as leaders are perpetuating. So, you know, not only can we influence it, we have to influence it. If we're really looking at driving performance, if we're looking at, you know, bringing two organizations together, if we're looking at, you know, introducing some new change in process, or even right now with COVID and, you know, the virtualization of our work teams, you know, we have to pay attention to that culture.
Yeah, absolutely, and I guess you're saying that that's some of the work that you do. So you're in a cultural context, you know, is it those self-limiting? But you know, I have a similar kind of definition. You know, I think it's, which is probably the manifestation of what you're saying there. You know, is often it's the conversations that you hear in the organization, which are the sort of tangible manifestation of that those mental models and mental frameworks that people have, and challenging that at scale. Then, and I'm thinking of this more from a kind of the people who are listening to the podcast from a kind of an internal communications perspective, and often there's a, you know, there's an idea around the psychology of internal comms about, you know, are we just kind of broadcasting these big corporate messages out there, or are we actually trying to get people to think and feel and do things differently based around challenging and exposing them to maybe an opposing set of beliefs? Is that sort of, you know, is that feasible, do you think, or does it need more of a kind of a, I don't know, more of an in-depth one-to-one approach when you're trying to do that culturally?
Well, you know, and your intuition is 100% correct, Craig. I think it was Ralph Waldo Emerson who said, you know, watch your thoughts, they become your words. You know, watch your words, they become your actions. So decidedly what individuals, those belief sets that they hold, the thoughts that resonate in their mind, they ripple in the conversations that people have. And so from a communication standpoint, if you look at organizations who have been the most successful at shifting culture, typically what they will always follow a very similar process. They start from a training perspective, because they have to have a unified way to deliver the messaging, the awareness that they're trying to bring to the organization. But then they support that on the backside through that communication side of things. So, you know, and again, it goes back to the conversation that we talked about earlier. So how are they going about reinforcing the optimal messaging or the optimal set of beliefs that they want to perpetuate? And how are they undermining the validity of the beliefs that people are holding on to right now that are holding the organization back? So there's decidedly a very strategic process of delivering that messaging to, you know, to shift those conversations.
Definitely. Do you ever find it's the case that, and I'm just genuinely interested in this from your experience perspective, as I think often I've worked with senior leadership teams, and there's a kind of, and again, it's this cultural sort of mind talk or self-talk that's going on within that team is around, you know, we've got the answers. We know what we need to do as an organization. It's just them out there who need to change and just need to kind of, you know, so it's almost like ours is the truth. Theirs is, their mental models are all wrong and we just need to fix them. I mean, how do you deal with that? Because I come across that, and there may be an element of truth in that. I'm not saying it's entirely misguided, but there is a sort of sometimes that it lacks empathy, and it struggles really when you're trying to, you know, kind of really get into their mind and sort of understand how there is an alternative way of looking at this. I mean, how do you deal with that? Do you find that's an issue with some of the organizations you work with, or have you come across that in your own career?
Oh, absolutely. It's, you know, what happens is, people who rise up through organizations, they get into senior leadership roles, you know, there's a cause and effect of why they sit in the seat that they do. And it's because they are an individual who was more accountable than other people, because they were an individual who was more adaptable, more resilient. They took initiative when others didn't. They weren't ruled by fears, you know, the same way. So, you know, so they moved based upon those five characteristics that we've talked about before. The challenge oftentimes, and this is, and it's really one of the, it's one of the, is you, if you want to help somebody to move from really being a manager to being a leader, a big part of it is helping them to understand why it was that they evolved to where they are in organizations, and to understand that not everybody's had that same set of influences that shaped them the way that they were shaped. So part of our responsibility as leaders in organizations is to give people those developmental experiences so that they learn to be more accountable and they learn to be more adaptable. They learn to be more resilient. I mean, we can sit and point fingers at them and say, well, if they would just, you know, all day long, but that's not going to change behaviors. The only way, you know, there's the fundamental truth about us as human beings is that our dominant thoughts and beliefs always drive our actions. And by the laws of cause and effect, our actions dictate our results. So if you want to change people's actions, you've got to change those dominant thoughts and beliefs. There's no other way to do it. And yet so often in organizations, if you look at whether it's messaging, whether it's training, it's always geared at that action level and the outcome level, but very rarely geared at that thought and belief level that makes all the difference.
Yeah. 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 I'm finding this coming up more and more in the conversation. And I don't know whether it's that, you know, COVID is flushing this out and there's this heightened level of like self and organizational awareness. But I think, you know, this whole idea that we need to sort of really start to empathize with different people's, you know, ways of looking at the world. I think there's definitely a heightened sensitivity to it, whether it will endure beyond, you know, the we're all in it together sort of mindset that, well, in certain areas anyway, that seems to prevail at the moment. But it is, yeah, I totally agree. And it's coming up more and more people I'm talking to. It's amazing how much this common denominator of we need to, you know, really understand each other's different mental models and be able to prepare to challenge our own as well and look at that objectively and say, you know, am I, because I think that's the other thing that I was just reflecting on when you were talking there, which is, you know, I always remember when I first started doing training years ago, there was this, you know, the idea of you know, we all start off unconsciously incompetent and work our way up to conscious, unconscious competence. Yep. But then there's a kind of a little sort of back alley back through to being unconsciously incompetent because we kind of develop all of these bad habits. You know, it's like you're driving, you know, you're consciously incompetent, but it's a very fine line between being consciously competent and consciously incompetent and actually just being a really bad driver and not realizing it. And I think it's similar with this sort of concept of you know, almost, I don't know whether it's applicable to motivational intelligence, but you know, you think you're this heightened sense of self-awareness, but actually you've developed a whole stack of blind spots. And sometimes you need a bit of a reality check and you need someone to give you a bit of a kick up the backside. I don't know whether that ever happens in your experience.
Well, there's, you know, what happens is, you know, it's human beings. We're fascinating from a psychological perspective, and there's decidedly defense mechanisms that people use to hide behind, they, you know, hide their own insecurities. And so when you see folks who, you know, have taken kind of that know-it-all perspective or conceited or arrogant or egotistical, and I mean, those are all defense mechanisms that people who struggle with their motivational intelligence use to hide behind, you know, so it's the force field, if you will, that they, you know, they use to justify not looking at themselves in a mirror.
Mm. Yeah. It's the same with, you know, like things like Myers-Briggs, isn't it? You know, well, I'm an ESTJ, therefore I'm, you know, really blunt and direct and, you know, and I kind of don't suffer fools gladly. And it's a little bit of a kind of a, you know, a defense mechanism or an excuse for sometimes inappropriate behavior. Not that I'm not having a go at ESTJs, by the way, there, anyone who's listening is an ESTJ. But I agree. David, I mean, I just wanted to sort of move on to maybe just to think about finally, if we're looking at this then from a perspective of, you know, a kind of practitioner level within an organization. So let's put ourselves, you know, let's think about someone who's listening in here, maybe who's in internal communications engagement, OD leader, you know, thinking about their organization. you know, and I kind of, what I've heard today has resonated with me. I this kind of motivational intelligence, the five different elements of the motivational intelligence model, which we'll put a link in that into the show notes. Where do I start? What do I do? So, you know, what's a sort of practical playbook for me to sort of think about? And I know there's like not one size fits all with this sort of thing, but where would I start in order to sort of start to raise this with my peers, with my senior management colleagues, and start to get this to something that we're thinking about and maybe thinking about actioning within the organization?
You know, the biggest thing is, you know, it's easy for us from an organizational perspective to look at the, when somebody's not doing something that we want them to do, or they're not embracing a new strategy or a new tool or a goal or those types of, so it's easy for us to see that. The broader question we have to begin to ask is why, you know, what, and really begin to think about what are the limiting beliefs that are resonating in the mind of that individual or that group that are causing us to move this way? And then what are we doing from an organizational perspective to begin to change those belief sets? And the beautiful thing is there's no shortage of ways to influence it. You know, one of the things we'll talk about oftentimes in sessions is what we call leadership moments. And in every conversation, and this is true of anybody that we interact with, but in every conversation, there will always be at least one leadership moment that's offered up to us. So, and that's that moment where, you know, we can challenge that limiting belief, or we can help that person to more clearly see the purpose behind the reason that they're doing what they're doing, that we can recognize them for, you know, for something that they're doing, that, you know, we can, you know, so it's the opportunities that we have in those conversations to influence the belief sets. And those are the opportunities that organizationally are missed all the time. And that's the, you know, people get very lost in the management side of, you know, of things, of fighting the fires and fixing the problems and reacting to the challenges of the days. But very rarely do they devote anywhere near enough time to the people side and influencing that, the mindset of those individuals. And yet that's, you know, it's the reason why we fight the fires. The reason why they come up in the first place is because people don't do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think there is a preoccupation with, you know, we just need to put out a really great town hall. You know, we'll do a really great town hall. We need to do a really great, you know, executive video of the VP talking about this, that, and the other. When actually, it's that rising tide raises all ships moments, isn't it? It's those little one-to-one conversations. And I guess COVID's trying to challenge that, you know, because the ability for people to walk out and, you know, even just get out of their office and go and walk around and talk to people and engage with people, it's finding ways to do that. But I think the spirit and the principle is still right, which is it's those touch points, those opportunities to just highlight to someone that great piece of work that you did and the impact it had on a customer who's phoned in and been really grateful. I just want to, you know, it's that ability to offer up to them something that they've done, and maybe a bit of appreciative inquiry as well can feed into that as well, in terms of helping people recognize when they're doing the right things and not being just having to guess all the time.
And it's not, you know, and it's not an either or, it's having a process that's aligned. So, you know, what's the messaging that our executives are giving? How are we reinforcing that from a communication standpoint? How are we empowering our leaders to have those conversations, raising their awareness first of the importance of it, you know, and then empowering them to do that? And how are we reinforcing that with them? And it's that congruence that shifts cultures.
Yeah. 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 I think it's that role of the trusted advisor, internal trusted advisor within the organization, whether it's, you know, the OD lead or the senior HR to ask those questions and to be that advocate for that around the table, I think. And that I keep coming back to this and time and time again with different interviewees. Again, it's great that there is that congruence and along a lot of these different themes that we've been exploring. So just in terms of resources, you know, I feel as though we just scraped the surface, and we could talk for another half an hour and probably still only feel as though we've scraped the surface with this. What in terms of resources are available either via, I mean, I'll put some links into the website, to your website, into the show notes to your website. Is there any specific resources that you've got that you'd recommend people go and have a look at, or is there any sort of diagnostics or anything like that that people can have a look at?
Absolutely, Craig. And, you know, by all means, please, I know you and I met through LinkedIn. If anybody would like to connect to me via LinkedIn, or even just look me up there, I do a lot of writing on behalf of Too Logical, from not just Forbes, but other publications. And so there's a wealth of resources that people can draw upon, you know, through my LinkedIn profile that Too Logical has put out. Both from in terms of videos and also in terms of articles. Certainly go to the toological.com website. There's a host of resources that you can find there if you want to learn more about our organization. One of the other things I'll kind of preview here, it's not publicly available yet, but we are also going to be releasing a motivational intelligence app that is going to be coming out. It's in late stage beta testing right now. It's called Mojo. And it's a coaching, mentoring, life building app that can be used both from an organizational perspective and also an individual perspective. For organizations that are interested in increasing the motivational intelligence of their teams, and also for individuals.
Oh, that sounds like a brilliant tool. No, yes, definitely. So I'll put it, and I mean, I'm on your LinkedIn profile now on my other screen, and I can see there's some very practical videos you've got there of, you know, my boss has a habit of interfering in the way I lead, you know, and so there's some real kind of go-to stuff there. And I'll put a link into your LinkedIn profile in the show notes and your podcast as well, which I mentioned at the beginning, which is very good as well. So definitely recommend, hopefully people listening to this are already podcast listeners anyway. So definitely stick that one on your subscription list as well. That's been really, really interesting. Fantastic. You know, I think meeting minds there on various issues. But I think, you know, I'm trying to do with this show is to give people some sort of tangential stuff. There's a lot of internal comms podcasts that are just focusing on, you know, the latest sort of app and, you know, you've just mentioned your app, but, you know, the latest way of delivering content to people. I want to challenge and provoke people to think really about it goes more than this. As internal comms and employee engagement professionals, we need to be thinking strategically, and we need to be calling out these behavioral traits that are helping or hindering our progress as an organization in developing a culture. And I think this idea of motivational intelligence is highly structured way of looking at that and of kind of thinking about what I can do practically and what are the focuses and almost being able to articulate what it is that I'm seeing that I can't actually put my finger on why there's a problem. So I think that's really, really, really helpful. David, I did warn you about this. I do have a tendency, well, not a tendency, it's more than a tendency because I do it on every episode. I do have a routine now of asking my interviewees a question that I've warned them about, but I don't know what the response is going to be. I'm as shocked or as surprised as the rest of the listeners are when I hear it. So I asked you to maybe think about something that even, you know, maybe people who know you pretty well in your work and social life don't know about you. And I know it's a difficult question, but tell us something that not a lot of people know about David Naylor.
Yeah, I thought a little bit about this one, Craig. You know, I'm a fairly public figure, so people know me, you know. I think what came to mind, and this is something that probably the only people who are very close to me know, but, you know, I think it's important for all of us as, you know, as human beings to figure out what success means to us. Yeah. And, you know, that way we're focusing our efforts and our energies and the directions that, you know, ultimately are going to mean something. I grew up, my father, was raised in a household where, his father was an abusive alcoholic. My dad ran away from home when he was 14 years old and never went back. So I never really had a much of a relationship with his father. And I remember when I was 16 years old, I was standing in our kitchen and the phone rings. I go over and pick it up. It was my Aunt Sandy. And she tells me that Grandpa Naylor had just passed away. And I remember I looked at my sister, who's 2 years younger than, or 4 years younger, rather, who was standing in the kitchen, and I told her that Grandpa Naylor had died. And at the same moment, we both said the same thing, which is, if you know my sisters, you know, probably the only time that's ever happened in our lives. and we both looked and said, no great loss to society. And I remember, you know, you have those moments in your life that just stick with you for whatever reason. And that's one that really stuck with me. And and I really started to think about, first, how sad it is that somebody could live for 75 years. And when they pass away, even their own grandchildren don't feel the loss. But it also, I think, in a lot of ways shaped how I came to define success. Because I, you know, it's... There's so many things that I think, you know, society tells us that, you know, we should look at as, you know, this is what makes us successful. But, you know, what I realized, I think, in that moment, and what I've, you know, really focused on in my life since then, is that for me anyway, and I'm not saying this is right for everybody, but for me, success is being able to, you know, to look back and say, you know, you made a difference. And, you know, that, you know, in some way, shape or form, you know, there were at least some people in the world who were, you know, positively impacted by your existence, and that there's a ripple that got, that was left from you. And as I have, you know, sadly, as you get older, you know, you see people around you who, you know, get sick and some, you know, end up passing away. And I found myself standing in, you know, many, many grave sites here. You know, and my final parting words to, you know, to so many folks is to tell them that, you know what, they made a difference. They made a ripple.
Yeah.
And that's what I hope I do, you know? So I think that's something that everybody knows.
Yeah. Well, that's a really, really profound, I think it's one of the most profound stories that anyone's told, but no, I think it really echoes, and particularly at this current moment in time, I think we're all probably got a heightened sense of mortality, haven't we? And you know, the fact that what will people, you know, will people remember us, you know, even beyond a generation, and will we have left a positive legacy? And I think it's it worries me as well, in that we live in an age where everything, you know, is just stored digitally, that you know, with all these kind of old photographs that we always used to have kicking about in shoeboxes around the building and places, is now if we ever use the internet, then we're kind of, it's all gone, isn't it? So we've got to be really careful about the memories that we leave, because that's probably going to be the most enduring aspect. So yeah, well, that's an amazing story. Well, thank you for sharing that. I really appreciate that. So it's, you know, it's clearly a very personal story, but I think, you know, one that we should all reflect on when we're thinking about the impact, not only in our personal lives, but in our working lives, that we, you know, I remember my one of my favorite bosses always used to say to me, it's not a unique, I know other people who have heard it, but, you know, people never remember for you what you did. They always remember you for how you made them feel. And I think that's, it's really important, isn't it, to have that kind of mindset when you're leading people and you've got that responsibility. Hey, well, look, let's thank you very much for that, and that's been a really amazing conversation. I feel emotionally and psychologically and intellectually very stimulated after that, and I'm going to go away into the weekend that's now imminent for me and not far away from you, and have a you know, it's going to be giving me a good buzz. So thank you very much for that, David. I really appreciate it.
Well, you're very, very welcome, Craig. It's been a great pleasure. And you've got a wedding anniversary this weekend, so make it a fantastic one. And you know, give your wife an extra hug there for that one.
I will. Thank you very much, David. You take care and look after yourself.
All right. Thank you. You too.
Thank you. you're looking for some other ideas and inspiration when it comes to internal communications and employee engagement, I definitely recommend you jump across to our website and have a look on our blog page, which is thebigpicturepeople.co.uk/blog. We've got a number of different categories of blogs there, different topics that we write articles on, all of which will be relevant. We write articles about culture, values, employee engagement, implementing change, communicating strategies, communicating vision and purpose, and other specific topics like health and safety, which we help our clients with a lot. We do a lot of work in that area as well. So yeah, we've got lots of blog topics there. You can sort them and you can filter them out and find out anything that might be of relevance to you at the moment, anything you're looking for some ideas or inspiration on, then that might be a useful resource for you. So thank you for listening to Engaging Internal Comms. Hope you found this episode useful. We'd love to get your feedback and thoughts about the show. So, and also any questions or ideas that you've got for things you'd like us to cover in future episodes. So you can email us at info@thebigpicturepeople.co.uk, or you can get in touch with us via the contact form on our website, which is engagingic.com. Also, you'll be able to sign up for our mailing list there, and we'll send you relevant news about the show, new episodes, and also anything that we think you might be interested in when it comes to internal communications or employee engagement. If you like the show and you haven't already done so, please subscribe to it via your podcast service. And also you can subscribe to it via the links on our podcast page, which again is engagingic.com. If you know anyone else who might be interested in the show, please distribute it to them. Please let them know about it. We want to try and grow a community of people here who are contributing to the show, giving us new ideas for episodes and things that you'd like to cover in future. So thank you very much.